you really have to think about the inferno in terms of paradise, because it's really too bad that we get so hung up on hell that we never get to paradise. And that really is true. I mean, a lot of people read the inferno and never read any more of Dante, and because of the fact that the inferno is very well written and very easy to grasp. I suppose hell is easier to grasp for us than heaven. Mm-hmm. He seemed to be. Charles Williams has a wonderful little statement about that. He says, we have to be naturalized to get into heaven. We're not born there. And we have these kind of dreamy ideas about ourselves that somehow we're all children of God. You know, God is our Father. Rah, 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 you know, sort of thing. You know, there's no, you know, heaven is just our native place, you know. You just feel so at home there. Well, you find that you may feel at home there, but hell is nonetheless very interesting. Well, then you can ask yourself, maybe I'd be bored in heaven. Yeah. I often ask myself that and ask other people that, how they assume that why should anybody want to go to heaven after death if they haven't enjoyed it on earth? I mean, God is going to be just as boring in eternity as he is now. So, you know, why gamble your life away and plan on heaven if it's going to be stuffy? And that's really the way most people think about heaven, that it is stuffy. And that's one reason that I think The Great Divorce is a really good book to read, and also a lot of the novels of this group, because they make you realize that our imagination simply hasn't begun to touch what, as the scripture says, what is stored up for man in the heart of God. And why we think our judgment is so good, I don't know, but we do. We think we can decide best. And this is why Dante paints hell with the kind of colors that he does, and he shows it with the contemporaneity that he does, because he's trying to get the people in his own time to see that it isn't, hell isn't some place that you choose later. It's what you're choosing right now, and then you just stay in it, you know? That's it. You've got it stamped, sealed, and there you've got your eternal security. Only it's the duration. People used to say when they saw Dante on the street, I don't know if I told you this, that they didn't talk about him as the man who had written the Inferno or the Divine Comedy or what have you. They just said, oh, you know, he's been in hell. And literally they meant that, because a lot of them really believed that you could make these kind of visionary trips. And in a certain sense, that's what Dante does for us in taking us through the Inferno. But we do have to remember that he would never have written it if he had not had a vision of paradise. I mean, if you don't have you don't move out of fear out of hell. You move because there is something greater that is dominating you and giving you a vision. That's what determined Dante's writing, not his fear of hell. But he did feel that it was important for people to realize that hell was not something that God judged people with and pounded the desk and said, you get so many years and so and so. But that, as I said before, the punishment fits the crime. The crime is the punishment in hell. And this is what Dante is trying to, he learns this himself as he goes through it, and this is what he's continually talking about all through these cantos. But if that were all, there would be very little to hope for, and it would be a very depressing kind of a thing. So I have to remind you of this, because very often we do get the feeling that this is all there is, it's just the Inferno, and many of you may never read anything beyond that, and you don't have to. It isn't essential for your salvation, nor for your literary salvation, to read the whole thing. But it is a good thing to know that the Paradise and the Purgatorio are really remarkable books, They really are. And if sometime in your future you have a week or so off, then you just decide you're going to read something. Not, I don't mean up here, but I mean some other time. It may come back to you, you know. It just might be that you decide to read it. And you won't be disappointed. I do want to talk to you this morning a little bit about a very important point in the Inferno, in the whole understanding of Dante's images and his explanation of what happens to people when they sin. How many of you have read as far as the canto that talks about Francesca and Paolo, the romantic pair that, you know, are in love and whirling around, and Dante decides to talk to them? Did we read that last time? I don't think we did we? I'm going to read it to you, and then I'm going to play part of Tchaikovsky's tone poem, which is the Francesca di Rimini, which is a very romantic interpretation of this event, and one that really pulls your heartstrings. All right, let's look at the gets into the second circle. Remember, the first circle is the circle of the wise ones who are without, outside of the gospel, outside of contact with any Christianity. And they are also people who are satisfied with what they have. They're the humanists, the great classical writers. And Dante is very proud to be included in that group for a little while. Remember that's what the first circle is about. Solzhenitsyn's first circle is about this group of great scientists who have real dedication to humanism, to the communist society, and to the real good of man. And you remember the tragedy of the first circle is when this one man particularly, remember, he finds out that they're working on all these great experiments, and they're to be used for the pulling down of their comrades and not for their building up. It's going to be used for more sort of Gestapo-like follow-ups on what people are doing. And but he still can't move into the other world, because humanism has bound him. And you find that the thing you feel in the canto about the humanists, about the first circle, is that there isn't any real, there's no real excitement and ecstasy and rapture. Think about heaven, and that's the thing that's so hard to get through our heads. We think hell is exciting and heaven is quiet, because I suppose because all our lives, you know, now be good and quiet. They always go together, good and quiet. Be nice and quiet. Now, if you're quiet, you'll get something. You know, just be quiet. Now, quietness is all right. And there's quietness that can be creative and receptive. But if quietness is dull, and if it's just because you just, you know, that's all there is, then you could well say, I choose a little noise. But I think that the problem is mainly a psychological one, that we think of quietness as being boring, and that's why we associate that term with the reward of quietness. If you're a nice, quiet person, you go to heaven, okay, then heaven will be quiet because you've learned to be quiet here. And it's not true, because heaven can't possibly be dull and boring. But that's the way we sometimes interpret it, as I said before. The problem with the humanists and the people in the first circle is that they are satisfied just with what they've got, walking around, nodding their heads, discussing. But there's no real excitement. There's no rapture, there's no joy, there's no ecstasy. Well, you know, what do you get? You get a feeling of real flatness. And it's quite a shock to move into the second circle and find that circle is full of wailing and howling and a darkness and a sense of great sorrow, and at least there's feeling. But the problem with the feeling is that it's going to lead eventually to a far worse feeling than what is there. And what Dante captures very clearly in this canto and in all the succeeding ones, but this is the most famous one in all of the Divine Comedy. It's the one that people always remember. Why? Oh, because it's so romantic, you know? Oh, they were killed because they were in love with each other. It's too bad. And what Dante does in this, because he himself feels bad, he is moved with pity over the situation. But what he understands and what he spells out in images, so that you have to discover this, but it's there, that the problem with it is that you snatch the moment for what it's worth and you want to live in that moment. Oh, carpe diem, seize the day, you know, stay with it. Hug it to yourself, and don't worry about the consequences. And Dante is concerned about the fact that an adult, responsible person who lives for the glory of God cannot live simply for a moment. A moment is simply not enough. Now, this is very much like Kierkegaard's aesthetic stage on life's way. If you think about it now and you go back and start mulling some of these things over your head, which will not come together until June or May, but I'm just, you know, dropping a few seeds in there so that they'll sprout when the time comes. But you'll be surprised how many of these things do interlock and bind themselves together. Because what Kierkegaard was concerned about in the aesthetic stage and in the what he calls the once-born person is the fact that that person too is always concerned about the immediate. You're concerned about the immediate sense impression or the immediate intellectual impression or the immediate ethical impression, whatever it happens to be, but you're not willing to take a responsibility for that. That means that you have to make a decision that may go against what you personally want to do at this moment. In other words, that the moment doesn't belong to you. The moment is part of a whole life lived to the glory of God. And if you live in this momentary thing, then you are going to be in hell because you want to keep that moment for yourself. This is what happens to Paola and Francesca. They're bound together, you know, loving each other, yes. But is it love? You know, it just lasts and lasts and lasts in that moment. And that's it. And I think I mentioned that last time, and I have to mention it again because it's so easy to get confused on this and say, well, Dante himself felt sorry for them and you know, that really wasn't quite fair. But what Dante is saying is simply that this is, that if you choose this momentary kind of living, if you choose just to grab for yourself every experience that you possibly can for yourself, you're going to find that that's what you're left with. Just a series of momentary experiences that have no real life and glory. Now, let's look at the second circle, Canto 5. And see, There's a wonderful line in here that I'd like to have you look at. Down on, we'll start with the top of the page there on 98, line 25. And now the sounds of grief begin to fill my ear. I'm come where cries of anguish smite my shrinking sense and lamentation shrill. A place made dumb of every glimmer of light which bellows like tempestuous ocean burling in the batter of a two-way wind's buffet and fight. It takes a little while, you know, you have to, if you're going to, don't you have a book, Matthew? I've got an extra one, if you need one. Okay. With these images, you really do have to, that you do have to let them kind of settle into a little bit, because they don't come very clearly right away, some of them.
The blast of hell that never rests from whirling harries the spirits along in the sweep of its swath and vexes them, forever beating and hurling. Now you get a real sense of almost being in a, you know, this kind of a thing, as if they were being in a great big drum that tumbles them and tumbles them and tumbles them. The clearest thing I can think of right handy is right below here in our big dryers and washing machines, you know, only more, a little larger, of course, and probably not so mechanical, but that's the kind of image it is. When they are borne to the rim of the ruinous path with cry and wail and shriek, they are caught by the gust, railing and cursing the power of the Lord's wrath. Into this torment, carnal sinners are thrust, so I was told, the sinners who make their reason bond thrall under the yoke of their lust. They make their reason bond thrall. That means a slave of the yoke of their lust. In other words, what do they decide? How do they decide something? They don't decide it because they think about it and say, this is the right thing to do. They decide it because, oh, it feels so good. It's where my passion leads me. And then this little image is one that anybody who has seen starlings, or birds anyway, like as the starlings wheel in the wintry season in wide and clustering flocks, wing-borne, wind-borne, even so they go, the souls who did this treason, hither and thither and up and down, outworn, hopeless of any rest. Rest, did I say? Of the least diminishing of their pangs forlorn. And as the cranes go chanting their harsh lay across the sky in long procession trailing, so I beheld some shadows borne my way. And you get this feeling, don't you? I hope some of you have had a chance in your life to see birds traveling across the sky in the fall and the spring. It's the most wonderful experience to see that. But this is a feeling of birds that are on the wind, that are sort of blown by the wind, and you see them just sort of trailing in their formations, but blown. And this is the way this is what this image is. A whole formation of sinners, you know, blown by the gusts and just whirled and whirled and whirled. And you get a feeling of ceaseless motion here. And then Dante, you see, gets really nervous about this because he says, some of those people must be people that I know. And Virgil talks to him about some of the famous people that are in the category of that group. And then all of a sudden, Dante thinks he gets a feeling that he recognizes somebody. And down on page 99 in line 73, he says, poet, said I, fain would I speak. Those two that seem to ride as light as any foam, and hand in hand on the dark wind drifting go. He replied, wait till they nearer roam, and thou shalt see. Summon them to thy side by the power of the love that leads them, and they will come. So as they eddied past on the whirling tide, I raised my voice, O souls that wearily rode, come to us, speak to us, if it be not denied. And as desire wafts homeward, dove with dove, to their sweet nest, on raised and steady wing, down dropping through the air, impelled by love, so these from Dido's flock came fluttering and dropping towards us down the cruel wind. Such power was in my affectionate summoning. You see, the power of love in terms of just plain concern that was in Dante's call was enough to call these people out of their whirl in hell and bring them closer to him so they could speak. And it was as you say, it was the power of his affectionate summoning. It wasn't the law that was leading, getting them there. It was a real gospel kind of concern. And then Paola, and then Francesca talks, oh living creature, gracious and so kind, coming through this black air to visit us who in death the globe incarnadined, we're the world's king, our friend. You see, this right away, she, you know, it's just like Adam blaming God. If God were our friend, but of course he's not, he hates us. Were the world's king our friend, and might we thus entreat, we would entreat him for thy peace, that pitiest so our pangs dispiteous. He hear all about the political enemies, the political treacherous and traitorous ones, like Farinata, for example. But they are all, still he wants to know what they are, and they're all allowed to speak, so that they can give the... There we go. The reason I was hoping it would start before you got too far away from what we read, because I want you to listen to this now. You can go back and look at that first, look at the canto if you want to, where it's in the canto 5. Does it need to be louder? It has some very loud parts, so probably better not to have it too much louder. Thank you.
lightning, but that's probably, that's part of healing.
This theme is the, you see, is the theme of Francesca and her, you know, her complaint. And you get a real sense. I don't think Tchaikovsky meant it, but you do get a feeling of wailing, as if she were sort of feeling really sorry for herself all the way along. You have a real sense of at least I do, of a sort of a self-pity that runs through it. But that's probably my subjective interpretation, because Tchaikovsky really identified with them. He felt badly for them.
Well, he was pitying himself.
Yeah, well, he was a pretty... Tchaikovsky did pretty well have self-pity, that's right. I should read this one thing. I hate to interrupt this, but you can listen to this by yourselves if you want to sometimes. This is a very bad recording. We've had it for about 40 years almost, so it's no wonder it's so bad. It's gone through so many floods and fires and whatnot. But I think that this, I want to read this one thing from Charles Williams on this particular episode, because I think you really sense it. Although he never talked about the Tchaikovsky music, but it does very much come out from his particular from his explanation of what really goes on here. What is the problem? I think, Carol, you can turn it off, because it gets much worse now. The cracks are worse. And then there's one part where it stops. It just keeps going over and over the same thing together, which, as I say, is very good, because hell is monotonous. You do the same thing over and over and over again. And I probably should keep, when you get to this, the record is stuck. And that's sort of a symbol of what hell is. You know, it's a stuck record.
What's the name of the album?
It's just one record. It's called Francesca di Rimini. And it's just one piece that Tchaikovsky wrote because he was so inspired by the Dante, by this particular episode in the Inferno, and by the Gustav Doré illustrations of it. So he just, you know, moved to compassion and wrote this. But I want to read this. It's in your notes, so that's one reason I wanted to read it. It comes from this particular book, which is an excellent commentary on the Inferno. It's called A Figure of Beatrice, A Study in Dante, by Charles Williams, the same man that we're going to read next week. He wrote these novels, and we're going to read Descent into Hell. But this is what, and if some of you may have read this, but I'm going to reread it just so that you, those of you who may have missed it, will be aware of it. Charles Williams writes about this particular episode. It is always quoted as an example of Dante's tenderness. So no doubt it is, but it is not here for that reason. It has a much more important place. It presents the first tender, passionate, and half-excusable consent of the soul to sin. Dante so manages the description, he so heightens the excuse, that the excuse reveals itself as precisely
the sin. The excuse reveals itself as the sin. The persistent parleying with the occasion of sin, the sweet, prolonged laziness of love, is the first surrender of the soul to hell, small but certain. The formal sin here is the adultery of the two lovers. The poetic sin is their shrinking from the adult love demanded of them and their refusal of the opportunity of glory. Now, I think I have to spell that out a little bit for you, because when you hear it read or you read it yourself, it doesn't always mean all that much to you, because you aren't accustomed to that, perhaps that particular style of writing. But what Charles Williams is saying here is that the very lack of responsibility on the part of Francesca, as she tells this story, is the excuse for the sin. Blaming it on everybody else is the sin itself, is because if she had not blamed other people for it, she wouldn't have gotten into it, because she wouldn't have been the kind of person that would have allowed it to happen. But a person who is always blaming other people for what happens to him or her is going to be the kind of person that's always going to be also living in the immediate, because he or she is not willing to be reflective. It's what William James called the once-born person. The person who doesn't want to use his intellect to think about a decision and make a decision. And when Dante says that all these people who are in hell have lost the good of intellect, it doesn't mean that their heads are no longer able to work. It doesn't mean that their minds, they've lost their mind. They're perfectly able to figure things out. They can graduate summa cum laude from a university. It has nothing to do with their abilities. What is gone is the quality of relationship to God, of the good of the intellect. Why we're given an intellect in the first place, to glorify God. And when you lose that, then the good of the intellect is gone, and you are beginning to be in league with the devil, and you lose that which you were endowed to be, a son of God, a daughter of God. So that's Dante's concern here, is this, as he says, and you get it so much in this Tchaikovsky, this parleying with love and this kind of dilly-dallying around, and should we or shouldn't we, and you know, it's just, you know, all this kind of titillation of the senses, not physically, but mentally. And in the music, it's orally. And this is what you get from, just look at this little bit of poetry. With no, we don't even know what Francesca looked like. And we certainly don't know much about Paolo, except that, you know, she thought he was a sweet, beautiful person. But otherwise, you don't have any of that. But you do have the experience, and you know, I wager that you will remember Paolo and Francesca, their names, more clearly, and they will be people to you in your memories far longer than a lot of people that you might recognize on a movie or a TV show that's a continued thing, like Mary Tyler Moore or something that makes you laugh and so on. But as far as gut reaction, something that really gets down inside of you, I think that if you really are reading this with any degree of imagination, and of course that's up to you, then these people are real people to you. And they signify a real experience in life that either you're warned about or you don't take the warning and you sink down into the same thing. We did talk about the bad situation with the gluttons. I might mention that these people in this part of hell are, as Dante is very careful to explain, are people who are suffering from a sin that is a mutual sin. It's not they share it. They're not solitary. That is, they're not people that are just living entirely for themselves. There's somebody else at least involved with it. And in terms of the old medieval category of sins, it's funny, but those sins were less venial. They weren't as bad as the sins of treachery and murder the kind of fraud that people commit against one another. The things that are one person's doing And you think, well, that's funny. Why, it'd be worse to have somebody else involved. But there is, in the beginning, something better about the sin in that, if you can compare sins as far as better or worse. And Dante does, and so do the medievalists. But the problem with all of these sins, however, is that eventually they get worse. That the monotony of the sin of Paola and Francesca is not going to just be this whirling, whirling, whirling forever and ever. Eventually, there's going to be a real running down of the record, a real just continuous frustration that eventually leads to a hatred of the other person, because there's no satisfaction, there's no future. And so that kind of sin, although taken in the moment, is that's the kind of punishment that it is. Hell does not improve, it gets worse. And so that sin of the romantic moment that is captured for a moment and becomes monotonous and wearing and blaring and tiring eventually becomes a murderous one in which you are biting and gnawing at each other. And some of the people in the later cantos, as you'll notice, are people who are in that kind of punishment and who are clawing and scratching and biting one another. There is one more person in that fifth canto or in that circle that I wanted to tell you about, and I wonder if I miss her. Well, I'll find her later. But the next cantos go from one circle to another, from one punishment to another, from one kind of crime or sin to another. There's one I want to discuss a little bit with you. I want to discuss the situation of luck or fortune. I wonder if perhaps you should turn to that. It's Canto 7. And there's some really good lines in there, too, that I think I'd like to just mention to you just in passing, because some of these things you should just underline because they are neat. There's one place here in the on page 111, and they saw all these people bumping against each other. They're in the fourth circle now, and these are the hoarders and the spendthrifts, and they're rolling huge rocks against each other. You know, it's really, you can't help but laugh because it just seems so, you know, they seem so really crazy. But then on the other hand, it is an agony. And as Dante says, God's justice, who shall tell the agonies heaped thick and new before my shuddering glance? Why must our guilt smite us with strokes like this? And in the on this top page of 111, he says, more than elsewhere, I saw them thronged and pressed this side and that, yelling with all their might and shoving each a great weight with his chest, sort of a great hellish soccer game, I guess. They bump together, and where they bump, wheel right round and return, trundling their loads again, shouting, why chuck away? Why grab so tight? You know, they're hollering at each other because they're trying to get these big loads out of the way, and instead of getting them out of the way, they bump into each other continually. Then round the dismal ring they pant and strain back on both sides to where they first began, still as they go, bawling their rude refrain. And when they meet, then each retreads his span, half round the ring to just in the other list. I felt quite shocked and like a stricken man. Pray tell me, sir, said I, all this. What is it? Who are these people? On our left, I find numberless tonsured heads. You know, the people that had their heads shaved was each a priest. This is a section I think is really, I like this translation of Dorothy Sears. In life, said he, these were so squint of mind. You know, that's a marvelous way to talk about ourselves or anybody else when we start hoarding. We're so squinting in our mind that we can only see what is really down our alley and what we need. In life, said he, these were so squint of mind as in the handling of their wealth to use no moderation, none, In either kind, that's plain from their shrill yelpings of abuse at the ring's turn, where opposite degrees of crime divide them into rival crews. They whose pates boast no hairy canopies are clerks. So don't feel, those of you who get bald, don't remember that there is such a thing as having a hairy canopy, and that's not so good either. Yea, popes and cardinals, in whom covetousness hath made its masterpiece. Why, sir, said I, surely there must be some faces I know in all this gang, thus brought by these defilements to a common doom. Nay, he replied, that is an empty thought. Living, their minds distinguish nothing. Dead, they cannot be distinguished. Now that's something, really, to think about. Alive, you distinguish nothing with your mind. Well, then when you're dead, there's nothing to distinguish you either. Nobody can tell who you are. The thing about heaven is that the differences are continuous and great. And as I told, I think I told you and I told Barb Rossing, that's the great thing about heaven, is that there are differences. And that's because your mind has learned to distinguish, and you've allowed the distinctions to become important enough to you so that you make decisions about it and you act on those decisions. But if you don't distinguish anything and you just let this one drive, whatever it is, whether it's romance or money or power or whatever, then what is there left? In this sort, they'll butt and brawl forever. When from bed the last trump wakes the body, these will be raised with tight fists, and those stripped hide and head. Hoarding and squandering filch the bright world's glee away, and set them to this tourney shock, whose charms need no embroidered words from me. And remember what Carol quoted from Roots, was it yesterday? Or about, you know, what Haley says, the old proverb from Africa, that a tight fist can get nowhere. You can't accept and you can't give. And that's a good kind of a thing to put there. And then he discusses, then Dante discusses the person of luck. And it's quite important because in the stories, particularly of Charles Williams, luck has this particular position. You can't say anything is bad luck, because luck has a position in terms of creation where she is like a, she or he, is like a god or goddess who determines where the power and where things are going to happen. It sort of takes it out of the realm of, you know, did God send this? You know, why does this happen to us? I mean, it's a kind of a balancing. Well, everybody gets it sometime, you know. Nobody is a cosmic pet. And so from one nation to another in the world, the power is moved, and the earthquakes come, typhoons go, and volcanoes come, floods and whatnot. All these things happen to people, disease and plagues and wars, and they happen all over the earth. And luck somehow shifts it around so that no country gets just one kind of thing. I mean, you don't get, the United States isn't going to be the blessed forever, you know, the place where everything is the end of the rainbow. And that eventually the wheel is going to turn and, you know, things are going to happen. The thing about the United States is it's such a big country, one country, that we sometimes forget that terrible things have happened in and out all over our country and been great disasters. But because we're so large, we don't feel it. You know, that part of our body is a little distant from where we happen to be. But this is important because luck then becomes a very much a sort of a servant of God, and not something that is just hit and miss. But it's an actual kind of a thing that makes what happens to the world fair. See, there's a fairness about it. Everybody gets chances one way or the other. Nobody is left without the same kind of opportunity. I mean, it may not be looked to us like an opportunity, but it is there. And this also gives you the sense that when the judgment comes, there will be people, for instance, as the scripture says, who did what they could with their non-knowledge. but they're brought in because of that. And this is a kind of a balancing that is not to be in our hands, but is in the hands of luck. And I think that if you see down here in on page 112, spreading the light equal on every side, likewise for earthly splendors he saw fit to ordain a general minister and guide. This is in the middle, 79. By whom vain wealth, as time grew ripe for it, from race to race, from blood to blood, should pass far beyond hindrance of all human wit. And then down then he says, for her your science finds no measuring rod. She in her realm provides, maintains, makes laws and judges, as do in theirs the other gods. Her permutations never know truce nor pause. Necessity lends her speed. So swift in fame men come and go, and cause succeeds to cause. Lo, this is she that has so cursed a name, even from those that should give praise to her. Luck, whom men senselessly revile and blame. But she is blissful, and she does not hear. She, with the other primal creatures gay, tastes her own blessedness, and turns her sphere. And so, I mean, she doesn't care if people say, oh, damn that luck. I get nothing but bad luck, you know. Doesn't bother luck. She just goes her way, and she knows what she's supposed to do, and that's it. Well, it's interesting that that's the way in which Dante interprets it, and this was the medieval interpretation, and Charles Williams accepts this and really weaves it very much into his writing. And he's got one book that is very interesting in this. That's the greater Trumps. It's about the tarot cards, and an exciting book, fascinating. And he works it out, and luck is very much a part of that book. Well, there's one line I'd like to I want you to notice before we move into the next one. That is at the bottom of page 113, describing these people, that they lie plunged deep in this vile broth, whose sighs, see there, wherever one may look, come bubbling up to the top and make it froth. Bogged there, they say, sullen were we. We took no joy of the pleasant air, no joy of the good sun. Our hearts smoldered with a sulky smoke. Sullen we lie here now in the black mud. This hymn they gurgle in their throats, for whole words they can no wise frame. I think that's a marvelous way to describe self-pity, and maybe what Bonnie was talking about last night. She should have read Dante. Sullen were we. We took no joy of the pleasant air, no joy of the good sun. Our hearts smoldered with a sulky smoke. Yes, even the cigar she smoked tasted like pig's butt, pig's feet. Our hearts smoldered with a sulky smoke. Sullen we lie here now in the black mud. I mean, it's a marvelous way to... And don't you see, when you read this, that how really stupid and flat and wordy a lot of our writing is? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the way this comes out and just... It's just like somebody took a paintbrush and just managed with just a few bits of color to make a whole thing for you to really hit you. And that's the way that I think that's one thing about Dante's writing you really get, is this, these images are not just abstractions ever. They're all fleshed. The beginning of Canto 8 on 116. I don't know how many of you have read The Fellowship of the Ring. Well, that's something I think some of you should read. I don't know if everybody should. But but those of you who have will appreciate this. The first three lines reminded me very much of Sauron's tower. I say, continuing, that ere we came to the tower's foot, our eyes had long been led to its summit by two twinkling points of flame which we saw kindled there, while far ahead and almost out of eyeshot, we espied an answering beacon's flicker. This is the watchtower on the city of Desolation.
And then down in when Dante is talking about people that are, you know, how strutting around on earth, this is what is said here. This one creature almost grabs the boat and grabs at Dante to get a hold of him. And he says, "This bold Jack was an arrogant brute in the world, nor in his whole life can remembrance find one sweetening touch. So must his raging spirit writhe here and roll. Many who strut like kings up there are such as here shall wallow hog-like in the mud, leaving behind nothing but foul reproach." "Master," said I tell thee, it were good if I might see this villain soused in the swill before we have passed the lake. Oh, that I could!" You see, Dante, you know, he's not always sweetness and light either. He really wants to see this guy dumped hard and deep. And he made answer, "Thou shalt gaze thy fill or ever thou set eyes on the far shore. Herein 'tis fitting thou shouldst have thy will." And soon I saw him set upon so sore by the muddy gang with such a pulling and hauling that I still praise and thank my God therefor. Can you imagine such a...
Well, it's really a good thing.
Yeah, really, very.
Not very.
"Have at Filippo Argente," they were bawling. "Loo, loo," the shade of the fierce Florentine turned on himself, biting with his teeth and mauling. There left we him, as does this tale of mine, for on my ears there smote a wailing cry, and I craned forward, eager to divine in its meanings. "See, my son, it now draws nigh," said my good lord, "the city named of Dis, with its sad citizens, its great company." And he sees the mosques, a red shell as though drawn out of glowing furnaces. And then, there's another line that I think is especially good, but over here on page 119, Virgil says, don't worry, we're going to make this, and because Dante's really getting nervous. "Then said my lord and leader, fear no whit," this is 103, "there's none at all can stay our steps, nor make thee forbear the pass. Such power hath granted it. Wait for me here. To cheerful thoughts betake thee. Feed thy faint heart with hope and calm thy breast. For in this underworld I'll not forsake thee." And then this line, "My gentle father's gone. I'm left distressed, abandoned here. Horrid perhapses throng my doubtful mind, for yeas and noes contest. His proffered terms I could not hear." And so then Virgil comes back to him. But I think that was a really great way to put it, horrid perhapses. The way you just feel like, oh, if I'd done it this way, oh, if I'd done it that way. I mean, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have gotten into this mess. You know, the awful thing about perhaps is, you know, if I'd only done it differently. I think that the note that Dorothy Sayers has on Virgil's repulse at the gate and the reason that he's not able to get in is one worth looking at. It's on page 120. It's the last of the notes before of the little explanation of the images before you get to the notes. Virgil's repulse at the gate. "Humanism is always apt to underestimate and to be baffled by the deliberate will to evil. Neither is it any sure protection against heresy." And that's the next canto is about that. But I think this is true, that so often humanism and people who think that human beings are perfectible and we're all going to, you know, human progress is a reality, they can't really admit that there is such a thing as deliberate evil. They always want to psychologize it. They want to explain it. Well, there's an excuse for it. If you just fixed up this slum or took care of that bit of education or did this or that or the other thing, you know, you'd straighten things out. The fact that man's heart is evil and inclined itself that way is something that the humanist can't really ever accept. And when he runs into a deliberate will to evil, as Virgil does, he doesn't really know what to do with it. And he's really surprised, and you notice that Virgil is very depressed by this event. The next cantos are about the problems of heresy, about the fact that
that the Furies, of what who are part of the classical mythology, are about to attack Dante, and he's really frightened by them. But Virgil is a wise person for him to have, because he knows what to do. He says, just don't let Medusa see you. Don't you look at Medusa. And you remember what happened? In the old myth, that if you looked at the Medusa, you turned into the snake. The snake had power over you. If you didn't see it, it was all right. And so he keeps his eyes covered, and he's all right. He gets into the next canto, and you get this person of Farinata, who is has been one of Dante's enemies. And he explains some of the situation with the souls in hell and what happens to them. And when you see him, by the way, you see him from the waist up, because he's sunk so deep. If you look at, on the top of page 129. Coming suddenly from a tomb, that in my dread I shrank up close against my escort's arm. Come, come, what art thou doing? Turn round, he said. That's Farinata. Look, he's risen to sight, and thou canst view him all from waist to head. Already my eyes were fixed on his. Upright he had lifted him, strong-breasted, stony-fronted, seeming to hold all hell in deep despite. And my good guide, with ready hands undaunted, thrusting me toward him through the tombs apace, said, in thy speech, precision is what's wanted. I reached the vault's foot, and he scanned my face a little while, and then said with an air almost contemptuous, what's thy name and race? Being anxious to obey, I did not care to make a mystery, but told all out. He raised his brows a trifle, saying, they were foes to me always, stubborn, fierce to flout me in my house and party. I was quick to chase them. Twice I put them to the rout. Quite true, and by that same arithmetic, said I, they rallied all round and came back twice your side, it seems, have not yet learned the trick. And that's just a little quick capsule of a political battle. And the reason that Dante is really writing this is that he's in exile. And this is what Farinata actually supposedly tells him is going to happen to him. And it's been a long battle in between the Guelphs and the Ghibellines in Florence. And Farinata has been the opposer against the church and against the truth. The people who stubbornly insisted that was right. They would rather follow their own conviction than what they found out to be true. They'd rather be in error than have it be their own error than find the truth itself. Now this is something that's hard for us to conceive of, because we want truth to be subjective. We don't believe there is such a thing as objective truth. We think truth is just however you find it to be. For Dante and for his world, truth had a validity. There was such a thing as truth. There was theological truth. And if you were wrong in your understanding of it, no matter how sincere you are about it, you're still wrong, and you're going to lose your way, and your end is going to be hell. And this is what comes very clearly through all the lines that have to do with the punishment of the heretics. And then in Canto 11, just before they go into the seventh circle, they look down at hell. And I think it's worth it to look at it, because you get an idea. If you look on page 138, you get a really rare picture. You see the surface and the forest and the hell gate, and then the vestibule, and then limbo, and where all these people were. Then all of a sudden you see the city of Dis, which is the city of heresy, and then you see this city of violence, where you see the suicides and the abominable sand, then the great barrier and the waterfall, and then all these other terrible people who are down below here. By the way, that last section there has some William Blake has done some great illustrations of Dante. And if you look in the Illuminated Blake, I don't know whether there should be some pictures of it down in that one, down there in the bookstore. And also, you don't have to buy it; you can look at it. You can look at it in the library. But
these pictures are really something, and Blake was a wonderful person to do Donkey, because he identified very much with the way in which Donkey wrote, although they would not have taken exactly the same theological point of view, because Blake had his own interpretations of everything. But let's just take a look at the way in which this is described, and then the way in which it looks, and how it looks when you see it in a sketch like this. Where a great cliff fell sheer, its beak... this is Canto 11, the beginning, page 134. Where a great cliff fell sheer, its beetling brow ringed with huge, jagged rocks, we reached the brink o'erhanging the still ghastlier dens below. And here so overpowering was the stink the deep abyss threw off, that we were through staggered, and for a screen were forced to shrink behind a massive vault where plain to view stood writ, I told Pope Anastasius, lured by Photinus from the pathway true. Photinus was a writer and a thinker who lured the Pope away from the truth, you see, so he got into heresy. We'll wait a while, the master said, that thus our senses may grow used to this vile sin, and after that it will not trouble us. But let's not lose the time so spent. Think now what compensation thou canst find. And then he says, see now, my son, three narrowing circles wind within these cliffs. Thus he took up the tale, each under each, like those we've left behind. Damned spirits fill them all. Thou canst not fail to know them at a glance. Though if I state how and for what they're here, pent up in jail, of all malicious wrong that earns heaven's hate, the end is injury. All such ends are won either by force or fraud. Both perpetrate evil to others. But since man alone is capable of fraud, that is, man by himself is capable of fraud, God hates that worst. The fraudulent lie lowest then, and groan deepest. So fraud is the worst thing, because a person can do that absolutely on his own. Of these three circles, all the first holds violent men, but as threefold may be their victims, in three rings they are dispersed. God, self, and neighbor. Against all these three, force may be used, either to injure them or theirs, as I shall show convincingly. And then he explains how all this punishment works out. You get a whole category of punishments. And really what it is an explanation of how life in society works itself out. Man on his neighbor may bring death or mayhem by force, or damage his chattels, house, and lands by harsh extortions, pillage, or fire and flame. So murderers, men who are violent of their hands, robbers and plunderers, they're all in the first ring. Against themselves, men may be violent, and their own lives or their own goods destroyed. So they in the second ring in vain repent who rob themselves of your world, or make a toy of fortune, gambling and wasting away their purse, and turn to weeping what was meant for joy. Those men do violence to God who curse and in their hearts deny him, or defame his bounty and his natural universe. So the third ring sets his seal on the double shame of Sodom and of Cahors, and on the speech of the froward heart, dishonoring God's great name. Fraud. And this is a marvelous description of fraud. Fraud, which gnaws every conscience, may be a breach of trust against the confiding, or deceive such as repose no confidence. Though each is fraud, the latter sort seems but to cleave the general bond of love and nature's tie. So the second circle opens to receive hypocrites, flatterers, dealers in sorcery, panders and cheats, and all such filthy stuff, with theft and simony and barratry. Fraud of the other sort forgets both love of kind and that love too whence is begot the special trust that's over and above. So in the smallest circle, that dark spot, core of the universe and throne of this, the traitors lie and their worm dieth not. And that's where you get the feeling, and if you look at that picture again, the next page, 138, you see where the city of Gis is, and you keep on going down, and the worm is down, 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 down at the bottom, and there's never any way for those people to ever come out.
I don't see where he's got the first frog.
your first thought?
Well, the thing is that their fraud or malice, complex and simple, is see on the side here, and actually the panders and the seducers are all part of the same whole. Of these three circles, all the first holds violent men, but as threefold may be their victims in three feelings, God, self, and neighbor. Against all these three, force may be used. The point is that the first, where does he put that? He moves them back. He puts the third ring, and then he brings up the second ring, and then he moves the second ring. He talks about the second ring way down in the where does he put that up? Yeah, no, and then also then he puts the third ring, so they in the second ring and they in repent, that's up in 40.
49, so the third ring, sixth,
yeah,
and the
double chain. Yeah, okay. Sodomy. And that's the beginning of the third, but the first one, I don't know why it doesn't have that separated.
Oh, and the first ring is 37.
Yeah, but I mean in the picture.
Oh, right, that's what I was asking.
Yeah, I don't know why that isn't, because
unless
the wood of suicides and the abominable sand, no, that doesn't come there.
On 180, he has another on
Line 180?
No, page
180. Maybe that's a better one. Well, that's the sins of the wolf. But you see, there again, it starts with the panders and the seducers and the flatterers, and you don't have the, I think the main thing is that whole first one is violence, period. You know, the whole section is, that he's talking about is the violence against everybody. I mean, that this is what force does with people. It explains it, and I think that he's not putting one particular group in that first one. He really. I think that they do actually start with the murderers, the robbers, and the plunderers, and the. Extortioners.
Where are the ones who sin against God?
Those men do violence to God, who curse and in their hearts deny him or defame his bounty and his natural universe. So the third ring sets its seal on the double shame of sodomy and of Cahors and on the speech of the froward heart dishonoring God's great name. They're the people that are in
As
a separate group, no, I don't think it is.
Okay.
They're all part of. I think this is just part of the. If they have the people that are in the diagram, all have specific punishments meted out to them. But these seem to be all just some of these are just descriptive of the kind of result that they have in their lives over against God, and not necessarily the kind of sin that is, I mean, the kind of punishment that is meted out for their sin. I'm trying to figure out where I had it underlined here. See, the first, in Canto 12, the river of boiling blood is where the violent against their neighbors are immersed, and the banks are guarded by the centaurs there. And that's such a terrible. I guess one reason I wasn't going to read that one is that the descriptions are so bloody and so awful. Especially that where they get so that they stand their toes only deep enough to cook the feet. I mean, you get the feeling of such exactness with which Dante is describing this particular
and they plunge eyebrow deep into this river of blood. But you see, that is part of the, that's up there in the Wood of Suicide in the Abominable Sand. That's the first group. So there, the group that's down below is, are these people that are just in one particular, all these specifics. See, up here, the Phlegethon has the violent people in it. And then the suicides and the abominable sand all comes before the, before you get into the section with the panders and the seducers. I'd forgotten about that. They all have a separate section described farther on. He's quite strong on usury as well as on homosexuality. It's really interesting that the two things come together in here because of the fact that he feels neither one of them is used for the right purpose. So, you know, it's one way that's Dante's way of explaining and saying that this is what happens to the people who use bodies or wealth for the wrong purpose in a perverted way. And this is what he's referring to here. Tomorrow night, I'm going to. I thought we should have one session on Dante for the community, as many people as want to come. Not everybody's interested in it, but there might be some people who could come at night who can't come in the daytime. So we'll just discuss a little bit of it, and take all the time to read some of the parts that are especially good and try to get at the. Center of the of it in terms of the threshold of consciousness and sin and so on. But if you have anything that that you particularly thought was a good line or a good section that you would underline, I asked you to either mark it or and you could tell us about it today, and we. I'd just like to take a couple minutes if any of you had found some line that you liked or some section that you thought was especially good. I'd like to hear what you thought about it. You may not have had time to do that much reading since Monday, but if you did, I'd like to hear about it.
On page 171.
Mm-hmm. 171.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's on truth, it's line 124.
Line 124. Okay.
When truth looks like a lie, a man to blame not to sit still if he can and hold his tongue, and he'll only cover his innocent head with shame. But here I can't, I just marked that
read, read the rest, but here I can't be silent.
Yeah.
And by the song of this, my comedy reader, hear me swear, so may my work find favor and live long. And then he goes on to explain what it was he saw. That's a really good. When truth looks like a lie, a man's to blame not to sit still if he can and hold his tongue, or he'll only cover his innocent head with shame. Anything else? Anybody else?
That whole ride is that monster.
Yeah, that's really something. If you look on Canto 15, page 162, there's a very good description. Hurrying close to the bank, a troop of shades met us, who eyed us, much as passers-by eye one another when daylight fades to dusk. And a new moon is in the sky. And knitting up their brows, they squinted at us like an old tailor at the needle's eye. I think that's a marvelous description of
page 162. That's line 16 through 21. The desert of burning sand is another one that's terrific. Ooh.
Yeah. But it was it his teacher that he's talking about in that camp?
Brunetto, the man that was the Brunetto Latini. It really is a sad thing. The thing that you get from Dante though is that even if the person himself is in hell, the what he did and his job as a teacher was a respected thing, and the function was right, and Dante had a right, it was right that Dante should have respect for him, because he had done his job right when he had worked with him.
Because that's a nice last line, not like a loser, but the winning runner.
Yeah, it is. That's very good. And then if you look on page, the top of page 157, talking about all these naked spirits that are wandering around in this desert of burning sand, and it's so much like it is up here. We've had so much more wind the last few days, but ordinarily this is a real description, only quite in the opposite direction, and slowly dropping over all the sand there drifted down huge flakes of fire as alpine snows in windless weather falls. And that's exactly the way the snow falls up here. Quiet, just day after day, just getting hot. And that's the kind of great flakes of fire that fell on this burning sand. It's not pleasant, but I mean, it's just that you can understand that image very well. I think there's a line here on page 151, line 82, Virgil is talking to the suicide, the people who had committed suicide, and they turned into trees. And it's really, it's such a sad experience. It's really, it's hard to, really hard to read it. And line 82, the poet, Virgil has asked him to say something, and Dante says, "Ask thou whate'er thou think'st will do my hunger good and satisfy me well. I cannot ask. Pity unhearts me so." Pity unhearts me so. It's a wonderful way to put it, that when you really feel, a real grabbing at your heart, you can't talk. You're just all choked up, and you don't have the heart to even speak what you probably should. And I know when I was reading this the very first time, in this edition anyway, I noticed on line 91 that just follows that, talking about how the souls get cramped into this knotty form, and if thou canst, if any shall, do off these limbs one day and find release therefrom. At this the trunk blew hard, and the windy puff after this wise soon whistled into speech. That's exactly the way it is when you have asthma. You puff, and your head is going to whistling noise that comes out of your lungs, and you talk with a kind of a whistling kind of an echo, a horrible sound. That marvelous description of the way the sound came out of the trunk of the tree. Remember in the Tolkien books, remember the ant.
Yeah, that reminded me of right away.
Well, there's so many good passages that I'd like to just keep running back and forth through them. On page 260. Oh, really good. This is a really terrible section, but he says here, he's wondering what had happened. It's down in line 91. Then I to him, he's asking the Virgil, "What shades lie there together rolled in a heap on thy right? That abject pair who smoke as a washed hand smokes in wintry weather." Mm-hmm. you wash your hands and it's cold and you see the steam coming up. They're so cold that this is what happened to them. This is the way they looked. And I think you have to go home to your mountains on the other side of the road, so I'll let you go. But I'm so afraid you're gonna miss some of these, and you will, because you won't read it all. You'll just say, oh. But do, when you do read it with a pen, so that the parts that are good, that you do underline them and kind of get them in your head. So there are some choice bits in here that will help to fix it in your mind, and you'll be glad that you've read Dante, because there'll be some images in your mind that you'll never forget, and it will help to take care of the poverty of the imagination that we're all afflicted with. All right. On Friday, I'm going to just talk briefly about the purgatory and the paradise, and then on Monday we'll discuss the Descent into Hell, Charles Williams' book, and we'll talk a little bit about Charles Williams first, and then discuss the book. We'll see how we get along next week, if you have a little time to read anything as frilly as a book, like a novel. You may have to only settle yourself in things like Becker and Luther and Kierkegaard. Why?
I'm ready for novels.
Well, I think really, you know, you can't read all. You can't just read straight theology. You've got to have some of your theology hit you obliquely. So you better read a little Charles Williams.